So this evening, we'll speak about a very special personality in our ISKCON movement who just recently departed the planet, His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami. Actually, it says in the Bhagavatam that when you try to glorify the Lord or the great souls, it's like a little bird trying to fly into the sky. The sky is considered to be unlimited. And the bird has what we say limited flying power. But as high as the bird can go, then there is something, some accomplishment. But the bird can never reach the unlimited sky. So when we try to speak about the glories of great souls, we can only speak a little, because the more we speak, the more we realize their greatness. Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, I know, is very closely related to the Croatian Yatra, and many have taken shelter as their spiritual master, eternal spiritual master. Of course, Srila Prabhupada is everyone's eternal spiritual master in ISKCON. Prabhupada has given empowerment to his sons to carry on his mission and spread Krishna consciousness, as he said, according to their own realizations. And Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj had many realizations on how to spread Krishna consciousness according to time, place, and circumstance. Maharaj was very special in many ways, and I'll speak something about it. We don't have very much time. Unfortunately, we have to stop for RT and then continue after. And then we have a video of Bhakti Tirtha Swami leading kirtan in Chicago, which was practically only a few months just before he came down with his illness. He visited Chicago in June 9, 2004, and just a few months later, in August, he was detected with the disease. So this kirtan, you'll see, is probably his last appearance in Chicago. And it's about 50 minutes long. And it's at a Sunday feast program in Chicago, Illinois. I have also one other thing that devotees may find some interest in. I was fortunate to be at the ceremony in honor of his disappearance on the day he disappeared. He disappeared on June 27th. At 3:40 p.m. in the afternoon. I came about an hour later after his disappearance, trying to make it there in time. I wasn't able to get there. I came there about an hour later. But that whole evening, starting at 9 p.m. and going into about 3 o'clock in the morning, there was a six-hour program in the temple. And one devotee, his name is Lakshmi Van, he's a disciple of Srila Prabhupada, and he's also a professional photographer, took many snapshots, photos of the event of that night. And I have a picture album that was compiled by myself and him together on the sequences of events that happened that night. And Lakshmi Van has made these pictures available for devotees. In the very last page, he writes his name, and he also writes his email address, phone number, address, everything. And if anybody wants these photos, you can contact him, and alongside of each photo, there's a number which identifies the particular photo. And if you like, you can order the whole book, or you can order whatever you feel you're inspired to. These photos are very well taken, maybe it might be a little difficult for some of you to look at these photos because it is the disappearance of Maharaj. But it was a wonderful ceremony. Radhanath Swami took care of Maharaj for 7 weeks up until his disappearance. And he was also there at that program that night. And he officiated much of the ceremony. I was also there. Dhanadhar Maharaj was there. And also many other senior Prabhupada disciples, including Vedavyas Priya Maharaj. So this photo album is in sequence of the events. And at the very end of the photo album, there are some photos of Maharaj before he left the planet in different kirtans and different situations. So what we'll do in order to facilitate time is while I'm speaking, I'll pass the photo album around and you can look at it while we're... and then we can also keep it throughout the night and devotees can look at it and if you desire to have any of those photos. He's asking for a small donation for each photo. And he also has one bulk price for the whole thing. It cost him a lot of money to do this whole project, so he is asking for a little bit of donation in return. But you can decide. Where to start? I don't exactly know where to start. I was fortunate and to have Maharaja's association practically throughout my whole Krishna consciousness time. Maharaj took initiation in he took his sannyas initiation in 1979, or 78 or 79, we're not sure. I think it was 79, in New Vrindavan, and I was also present at his sannyas initiation. But our friendship started to develop around 1990s when Maharaj was preaching in America. Just to narrate his whole life is interesting. It's interesting that he grew up in a very difficult situation. He was one of six children in the family. He was the youngest. He had four sisters and one brother, and he was the youngest in the family. His mother practically took care of the family alone. His father was not much part of his life. Although he was living, still he was not very much connected with the family. Maharaj grew up in the ghetto. And the ghetto means in the area where there was a lot of drugs, a lot of crime, a lot of violence in a place called Cleveland, Ohio. He described, going to school was like, going into an armed camp. It was very difficult. He struggled through that and somehow worked hard at school and got very good grades, where he was given a very special privilege that black people hardly ever get. He was awarded a scholarship to one of the top universities in America. And there are about six universities that are called Ivy League schools. Only the most richest, influential people go to those schools. And you really have to have connections to get into these schools. He got into one of them, known as Princeton University. And being a black in that atmosphere was very difficult because it was a very white, racist type of atmosphere. But somehow, he went to school, got interested in civil rights movements, campaigned for the blacks in America, joined the famous Martin Luther King, and became a party to his program in trying to develop civil rights for black people. And he worked very hard. He was always a champion for people who were deprived. that was his mood. He was always concerned about the little person, the underdog, the people who were suffering, the people who were deprived, the people who didn't. And he grew up in a situation where he saw that all around him. So he joined Martin Luther King, also became connected with other programs with the United Nations. And in this atmosphere, you know, he struggled to preach civil rights. At one point in his life, he started getting into spiritual movements. And he came in contact with one yogi in America, who he started to take yoga lessons, meditations, and he was going to him for some time. But at one point, when he came to visit the yogi one day, the yogi says, you shouldn't come to me anymore, because your spiritual master is A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the spiritual master of the Hare Krishnas. He said, I can't take you any farther in my teachings. If you want more teachings, you have to go to Bhaktivedanta Swami. But he kept coming back to the yogi because he didn't know who Bhaktivedanta Swami was or who the Hare Krishnas were. And finally, after 3 or 4 times, the yogi kept saying the same thing. You should go and find Bhaktivedanta Swami. So he did. This was in the early 1970s. And he came in contact finally with the Hare Krishna movement. He explains how when he saw the devotees chanting and dancing, he was thinking, what are these people doing? They're just having fun. This is not yoga. This is yoga serious. But it's just people dancing around and singing like children. Later on, he became one of the most enthusiastic dancers and kirtan leaders. But he was seeing, and then when they served out the prasadam, he was thinking, this is all sense gratification. They're eating sugar and all kinds of nice preparations. This is all sense gratification. Yoga means austerity. So finally, of course, he saw it differently. But when he first joined the movement, he was very austere. Prabhupada gave him the name Ghanisham, initiated him, I think, in 1971. And he was so enthusiastic to serve, and also so enthusiastic to perform austerities. He got involved with Satsarupa Maharaja's library party, which were traveling in that time all over the United States. But later on, they went to Europe. And they went actually into areas within Europe which were very difficult to go into. Their whole service was to put full sets of Prabhupada's books. And of course, there weren't that many at that time. That was back in the early 70s. But whatever Prabhupada had translated, they were trying to put into colleges and universities by contacting professors. And it was very difficult. He went into countries such as communist Poland, East Germany, also Czechoslovakia, and many other places. And for a person from the black race to go behind the Iron Curtain and preach Krishna consciousness was totally unheard of. He risked his life. If he was to have been caught, he could have been put in jail for life or maybe even executed. Because at that time it was very, very strict. He's okay. So, but he was fearless. He liked challenges. He liked to take risks for spreading Krishna consciousness. In his preaching in communist countries, He doesn't tell a lot of stories. He wrote a lot of stories in his letters to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada kept those letters, and Tamal Krishna Goswami every day would bring Ghanisham's letter to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada would eagerly read it, and how they were distributing books in communist countries. There's one story where I think he was in Czechoslovakia, and he was distributing books on one campus or ready to visit some professors, and the secret police found out that he was there, so they were after him. So he was running from the secret police, and he, in order to escape from the secret police, he opened one door of one professor's office and just walked in, and the professor was sitting in his office, and he was shocked. He got up. Who's this person coming walking in my office, just like running in? Immediately, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj thought fast. He handed him his card, said, "We are with the Bhakti Vedanta Book Trust Library Party. We're putting books in the library," and he started preaching to the man, and he sold him a set of books. After running from the police, he walks in and sells this man a set of books. During that time, he was with the devotees, and Maharaj was very austere. He would chant 42 rounds a day. He would get up at 1 o'clock in the morning, and he would never eat until he was done with all his service throughout the day. He felt that stopping to eat was just a waste of time. And he was very austere. He told me in those days he was eating 2 carrots and an apple every day. Very austere. Working hard, chanting many rounds, and he was like leading the party in sales. And the other devotees, after some time, felt that his austerities were causing so many problems because they couldn't keep up with him. Getting up at 1 o'clock in the morning, chanting 42 rounds and just working hard all day, not eating. So they all had a meeting and decided to quit because they felt it was too difficult to work with him. So they told him, "We're going to quit. We can't work with you. It's too difficult." And he said, "If that's the case, then I'll drop my austerities." He did. Just to please the other devotees. He did it because he didn't want to see them, unhappy or dissatisfied or even leave. So he gave up his austerity to a certain degree, not completely, just to satisfy the other devotees. So he continued on. And there was one time he told me he was preaching in Germany behind the Iron Curtain, and the secret police found out about him. So they were coming in the front door, and he was in the room. So he jumped out the window and ran out the window and hid underneath the car until they left. So you can imagine what it was like preaching in those days behind the Iron Curtain, trying to distribute Prabhupada's books. Difficult. There were many, many stories. But he liked to take risks for Prabhupada, for spreading Krishna consciousness. This was his enthusiasm to serve. He was fearless. When Prabhupada was sick in 1977, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, and Prabhupada had decided to go to Gita Nagari. His health became a little better in September of 77, and he decided to go to Gita Nagari and set up Vanashram Dharma. Prabhupada said, "Only half of my mission is complete. I've spread the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, I've spread the Sankirtan movement, but the second half of my mission is Vanashram. I have not set that up. So before I leave, I want to teach the devotees how to do it." So Prabhupada got a resurgence of health, and he was planning to go to Gita Nagari and set up Van Ashram, show the devotees personally how to do it. So he left and went to London, and on his way to America. But when he got into London, his health became really bad again. So Prabhupada was forced to, you know, give up his trip to America and return to India. And while he was there in London, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj came and saw him. And Prabhupada was sitting behind his little desk. And when Maharaj came in the room, Prabhupada got up. He walked over him and embraced him. He said, "Your life is perfect." Told him that. Now, for the devotees who knew Prabhupada, who spent time with Prabhupada, Bhakti Tiru Maharaj said this, and a few others senior devotees said, Prabhupada hardly embraced anybody. It was very rare that Prabhupada embraced, especially one of his disciples. I think he did it once or twice, and Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj was one of them. He said, "Your life is perfect." When the spiritual master says, "Your life is perfect," your life is perfect. There's no question about it. And so he received a special, special, special mercy and blessings of Srila Prabhupada. Later on, he went back to America and decided and started to develop innovative preaching. This was in the 80s. And he opened up the Institute for Applied Spiritual Technology in Washington, D.C., which was a house that his devotees had gotten him, and he transformed it into a small temple preaching center. And he was preaching generally the way he was preaching today. He was reaching people who were professionals, who had jobs in the material world, who were, you know, people who had a lot of skills. He was preaching issues, not so much direct Krishna consciousness. He was also doing that. But he was also reaching people with things such as issues, such as war, love, you know, male-female relationships. And he attracted a large group of professionals. When I say a large group, it was a large group. People came who were doctors, nutritionists, yoga teachers, martial art teachers, people of that caliber. In fact, they even set up a martial arts center in Washington, D.C. He attracted three or four people who were expert in martial arts, and they set up a center there. And they were giving lessons in martial arts to the general public, but teaching it based on Krishna consciousness principles. And they would have a large murti of Lord Nisringadev there. And that way they were gradually reaching people from the perspective of martial arts. That was Maharaj. He wanted to reach people according to where they were at and bring them in from that perspective. He was famous and very successful for what is called bridge preaching or risk preaching, where you go into areas and you speak the language of the people that you're speaking to, but you use generic spiritual principles to gradually incorporate that within their lifestyle, where they gradually start to develop, you know, spiritual principles within whatever they're doing, and then gradually bring them closer and closer to Krishna consciousness. And he was expert at that. And he's very successful. Practically in our society, he was the most foremost of preaching to the general population. And he was very successful in reaching people from all walks of life. To jump ahead a little bit, when he was in Washington, D.C., he was giving classes in Georgetown University to people who were in the Pentagon in America, who were in the military, on leadership, preaching about leadership. And people who were coming to his classes were generals and other army officers and Pentagon officials we're taking classes in leadership from Bhakti Tirtha Swami. At the end, they gradually found out he was a Hare Krishna. But still, they never said anything, never complained. At the beginning, of course, they didn't know. He was also preaching, you know, to doctors and other professionals, trying to incorporate the qualities of leadership in people's occupation, spiritual qualities of leadership. And that society, the Institute for Spiritual Technology, was a great success. Many people were coming, very qualified people. And more people were becoming his devotee, actually taking initiation, becoming a devotee. Personally, that was my real development in my relationship with Maharaj during that time. In 1987, I was preaching in one city in America called Cincinnati, Ohio. I was running a preaching center. And for many years, I was running that preaching. For a few years, for 2 years, not many years. And in 1989, I closed the preaching center because we were connected to New Vrindavan, and New Vrindavan was having problems. But then, on my own, I reopened the preaching center in 1991 and restarted the whole program again, single-handedly, trying to run the preaching center, maintain it, doing everything. And gradually, we had a nice congregation, a local congregation that adhered to that preaching center. We would have programs many nights a week. And this went on for a few years. But then again, it became a little bit difficult for me to run the preaching center by myself. And at the same time, I was in the sannyas ashram. So I was doing a lot of just taking care of the building and a lot of the externals and not a lot of preaching. So the question came up, should I continue with my service of running the preaching center, or maybe go out and just travel and preach and take up the business of the sannyas ashram? But leaving the preaching center meant that the preaching center would close, and there were people coming. And so it became difficult, because that was the years when New Vrindavan had gotten away from ISKCON. So it wasn't a lot of support at that time. And none of the devotees at New Vrindavan could take up, you know, that job of running the preaching center. So in 1993, when New Vrindavan, the leadership in New Vrindavan was exposed for a lot of deviations in philosophy and in moral character, practically the whole New Vrindavan community fell apart. And there was devastation, there was a lot of problems. New Vrindavan had been kicked out of ISKCON in 1987 because of their deviations. But in 1993, the whole thing fell apart, and then there was a lot of infighting. There were two camps. So I was still connected with New Vrindavan, but preaching outside. And there was at least 60 devotees, 60 congregational members that were connected to the center. So the question arose, should I continue the center or should I go out and preach? So remembering that the duty of a devotee when he has to make a big decision is to consult other devotees to get their advice, I followed that instruction and I consulted as many senior devotees as I possibly could. And I got answers on both sides. Some said continue the center, others said go out and preach. And it became a problem. So for 1 month, I was struggling what to do. And then one day, I came to Washington, D.C., and I came to see Bhakti Tirtha Swami. And I was sitting in his office, and we were talking. So I presented my problem. Maharaj, what should I do? Explain the whole situation. Should I continue preaching in the center? The people are coming, they're depending on me. Or should I go out and preach? He said, he looked at me, he stood up, and with a wave of his arm, he said, go out and preach. And I had heard the same statement before from other senior devotees. But this time I heard the voice of Krishna. I was waiting for the voice of Krishna to come through, and I hadn't heard that before. But when Maharaj said it, he said it with such conviction and with such assurity that this, I understood, yes, this is coming from Krishna. And then, of course, I followed that. And to this day, I'm glad I did. But the point was that I was waiting to hear Krishna's voice, and I didn't hear it before, and then I heard it this time. Or I wasn't able to hear it, but when Maharaj said it, I did. So he was very instrumental in helping me get involved with traveling and preaching. There's so many stories, and we have so little time. Is it possible we can go through the RT and speak? We can do that, or we can, and we can also have kirtan at the end to make up for that. But there are so many wonderful stories. In 1996, the Maharaj got really inspired to take up Prabhupada's project in Gita Nagari. He knew Prabhupada's desire to make Gita Nagari a place of self-sufficiency of anashram dharma. But the situation in Gita Nagari was bleak at the time. There were many families living there. It was a community of families who lived in houses all around the temple in surrounding areas. But Mangal Arti was about 3 people. And there was about 100 cows at the time, and it was 1 cowherd boy. There was 1 cowherd boy, 1 Mataji whose name was Kalini, Mother Kalini, a Prabhupada disciple. She was practically taking care of the deities, cooking the offerings, milking the cows, maintaining the whole thing. And the rest of the community didn't want to get involved. They had fallen heavily into Maya. So Maharaj thought, I'll go to Gita Nagari and I'll set up self-sufficiency. I'll bring my devotees with me. I'll inspire the rest of the community, and then we'll work on that project. So with great enthusiasm and with big plans, he had seminar after seminar with his devotees on how to institute self-sufficiency. They were talking about, ox power, various types of agricultural project. Now you have to understand one thing. Every one of his disciples were city people. They didn't even know what end of the cow you were supposed to milk. I'm serious. They came from the city. They had good jobs. One of Maharaj's very close disciple went. He was making $600 a week as an accountant, wearing fancy suits. They had good cars. I mean, he preached to people who had money, who had influence, who had, they were all city people. And he told them, we're all going to go on the farm. And for them to go on the farm, it was like, what's a farm? because they were so surrendered to Maharaj, they wanted to please him. So they tried. And I was involved with this directly. Maharaj was having seminars for weeks and weeks and weeks, having his devotees research libraries on self-sufficiency and compile information. And so he finally persuaded a group of his devotees to get involved. Not all of them. They all wouldn't go, but partial. They came and gradually started to move into Gita Nagari. But what happened was that there were 60 families living at Gitanagari at the time. And I know because Maharaj asked me to take a consensus. So I did a little survey and we found there were 60 families living there. Not one of those families wanted to support Maharaj's project. Actually, one family did. They were interested a little bit because they were doing some self-sufficiency. But later on, they didn't get so much involved. So Maharaj, when he got there with a handful of devotees trying to set up the self-sufficiency, he realized that it's not going to work. It's just not going to work. Before I develop self-sufficiency, I have to build community first. So he switched his whole program and developing community and teaching Vaishnava relationships. And for years, he had seminar after seminar, meetings, discussions, various types of workshops on Vaishnava relationships and Vaishnava and community building. And in 8 years, from 1996 to 2004, he built a wonderful community of devotees there who were, willing to surrender to the farm. Many gave up their very high-paying jobs in the city, came to the farm, bought houses, and slowly and gradually, took up the process of trying to build Gitanagari. But very little building did get done. But something happened. But the most important thing is that the community of devotees that exist here today are very wonderful devotees. Very wonderful devotees. They're very humble. They have a very wonderful service attitude. They're very enthusiastic for Krishna consciousness. They're very well. They take care of guests so nicely and so care. It's one of the nicest communities in ISKCON society. It was all due to Maharaj's hard work in teaching devotees Vaishnava relationships and in community building. And he did that practically from scratch. Unfortunately, he never did really develop the self-sufficiency program because at that time he spent all his time building community and Vaishnava relationships. Although something didn't manifest. At the same time, Maharaj was preaching and he's developing his preaching in Africa. Oh, I should let you know one thing. I'll stop here for just a little note. Satyaraj Prabhu, whose name is Stephen Rosen, you know Satyaraj, he wrote many books. He's doing a biography on Maharaj. So there will be a biography, the history of the life of Maharaj. He's compiling information. If any of you have something you may be able to offer, I have his contact. You can get it from me. You can write him on email. He's doing the biography in the same way that Satyarup Maharaj did Prabhupada Lilamrita, in that same format. He's writing it in historical sequence with dates, places, events, and persons, and interviews like that. So he's working on that biography now. Bhakti Tru Maharaj is doing a film on the life of Bhakti Tirtha Swami. It'll be a feature film. He said about an hour and a half, 2 hours long. It'll be not like Abhay Charan in series, but it'll be one feature film about 2 hours long. Also, there was a girl in Russia that wrote a biography on Maharaj. So that there's one published in Russia also. I guess I can talk about what he did or what he was. There's both are important. What he did was a product of what he was. He struggled because his preaching was a little bit different than the standard, what we say, ISKCON protocol for preaching. And many times he was also not criticized, but questioned about the type of preaching he was doing. But he showed by results that what he was doing was in line with Prabhupada's philosophy, and that he was preaching in such a way as to bring people in from wherever they were. And his preaching in Africa was very difficult. He told me some really stories in Africa. He told me one story where he would preach to kings and political leaders and heads of state. In fact, after so many years of preaching, he was successful. He had a one-hour TV show, which was nationwide in many of the countries in Africa, Nigeria, and Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and other places, especially Nigeria. But Africa was a difficult place because there was always revolutions going on. A king would last for a year or two, and then somebody else would come in and overthrow him for a revolution. But Maharaj got close to many kings. He told me one time he was preaching to one king, and this king had a whole series of ministers. Now, the king liked Maharaj a lot, and so Maharaj had a lot of personal, private discussions with the king. But the ministers were getting envious. They were feeling envious. He's getting so close to the king, and they were feeling very envious. So he detected that they were going to do something. And he was right. He said one day when he was driving in a car in that country, he had been given a driver to drive his car who was a local man. And Maharaj was sitting in the back seat and the man was sitting in the front. So the man was driving. And while he was driving, all of a sudden, for no reason, he turned the wheel straight on into the head-on cars. And it was a head-on collision. Maharaj said, I thought of Krishna at the time. I chanted Krishna's name. Fortunately, he said, Krishna saved me. He got away with a few scratches. But he said that he was sure, no doubt, that these ministers, they're very expert in using voodoo. It's kind of like a black magic mystic power. He said they put a spell on the driver and caused him to act like that so they could try to take the life of Maharaj. But there, he said they didn't consider the Krishna factor. That's what he said. He told me that. Preaching in Africa was difficult. One time, he said he was traveling from one country to another, taking a plane. And they had overbooked the flight. Way overbooked the flight. It was way more people than they could fit on the plane. So in Western countries, if they do that, they usually offer you some travel voucher free if you give up your seat and you get a free flight at another time and some money. But not in Africa. They don't do that. So how do they solve the problem? You want to hear? It's really an interesting way they solve the problem. They told everyone to get off the plane along with their luggage and go to the other end of the runway and have a race. And the first ones who got on the plane got the seats. He said, I was fast and I got on. But there was old ladies and, you know, children. They were running with their luggage. And this is how they solved the problem. So, welcome to Africa. It wasn't easy to preach in Africa. Another time he said he was on a plane in Africa and it wouldn't start. They couldn't get the plane to start. So they asked everyone to get off the plane and push the plane. And of course, you know, like sometimes you do that with a car, you know. They did it. It started and they got everybody jumped back on the plane. So Africa was a difficult place to preach in. But, you know, he told me one time, this was a confidential moment, we were sitting together in Gita Nagari, he told me something very confidential. He said, One time I had a dream, he said, one night. And Prabhupada appeared to me in my dream. And I was sitting in the room with Prabhupada. And I was sitting on the floor near Prabhupada's lotus feet. And Prabhupada was just sitting there. And we were both just sitting. And he said, I was feeling so happy just being with Prabhupada. And then Prabhupada, all of a sudden, he pointed to the door. And he said, let them in. Let them in. So he got up to look to see on the other side of the door. And he saw me. It was this whole large group of people from the black race. They're all standing outside the door. And Prabhupada said, let them in. So he told me the meaning of the dream was that Prabhupada wanted him especially to preach to, you know, black race. Because he had that Shakti, he had that connection, he had that culture. So Prabhupada wanted to, you know, make everyone in the world, no matter what culture they were from, Krishna conscious. So Bhaktivedanta Maharaj played a big role in bringing, of course, many people from all countries, but people from the black race very much gravitated towards him because he understood their mind, he understood their mentality. Maharaj, as you read his books, Spiritual Warrior, the Beggar series, and of course the Sacred Teaching series, you see especially he's always concerned with alleviating and uplifting people who are suffering. His latest book, just released, Spiritual Warrior 6, talks about problems in the world and how people are suffering on so many levels. He talked about counteracting the culture of violence, nations, ignorance, selfishness with the culture of love, the culture of devotion, the culture of selflessness, the culture of Krishna consciousness principles. And he was a leader in that area. He preached it and he also followed it. I used to go and see him in Gita Nagari, because when he would come to the United States, I would find out his schedule and I would always go and see him. And he would always be happy to see me and I'd come in, and he always had time. We would sit, we would take lunch together, and we would talk together, and we always had time. But he was always busy. He would work 24 hours a day in Krishna consciousness. I used to see him. He would get like sometimes 100 or 200 emails in a day from devotees around the world. And he would stay up all night. He would do his services all day with the community, and then in the evening he would stay up the whole night just doing emails, answering letters. He must have burnt out a number of secretaries who couldn't keep up with him trying to type his emails. Many of his devotees used to come and tell me, I can't keep up with Maharaj. He wants me to stay up all night doing letters and typing. You know, they weren't as surrendered as he was. But that's the way he was. He worked so hard. He told me, I want to use every moment of my time to serve Prabhupada. I don't want to waste one moment. This was his mood. There are many other stories. I don't know where to start. At the end, I'll read... Maybe you heard it or read it already. The statement by the GBC for glorifying Maharaj. But he was tireless in his preaching. I remember when I was in London, I had just gone to Soho Street, and I had just given a class, and I was leaving Soho Street to go to Bhaktivedanta Manor. And the driver was telling me a story. He said, you know, there was one man, he was coming to the Soho Street temple, and he was trying to be a devotee, but he couldn't get into the program, couldn't follow, it was too difficult. So he left, gave up Krishna consciousness, stopped coming. Then he came across one of Maharaja's books, Spiritual Warrior 2, Transforming Lust into Love. He read the whole book, said, "This is great, answers all my questions," came back to the temple, joined, chanted 16 rounds. And that's one of many stories of devotees who somehow or other maybe just couldn't connect with Prabhupada directly. But after reading his books and understanding the connection between their problems in the world and Krishna consciousness, actually became very fixed devotees in Krishna consciousness. His second book, Spiritual Warrior 2, Leadership Number 2. Have you read that one, Leadership 2? It's an amazing book. He wrote the book, and then he found the, what they call the ghost writer from Stephen Covey. Stephen Covey is, I don't know if you know who Stephen Covey is. He's one of the most prominent people in the Western countries who preaches about leadership, qualities, efficiencies, how to do things. His ghostwriter, who writes for Stephen Covey, agreed to write the introduction for Maharaja's second book, Leadership. He wrote that, you read that introduction. He writes in that introduction that this is better than Stephen Covey's work. That I have never read anything so right on about leadership. This is amazing. This is revolutionary. This is the essence of the teachings of the how to develop leadership and spiritual qualities. So he influenced many people like that. He became personal friends with Nelson Mandela in South Africa, was preaching to him. And Nelson Mandela, they had dinner together. He told me Nelson Mandela was telling him his whole life, how he grew up in a very poor background, and how he struggled to fight for the black people's rights in South Africa. He also met persons like Muhammad Ali, preached to him. Also Alice Coltrane, she was a famous singer in America. And he actually preached to her and helped her become Krishna conscious. She took up Krishna consciousness in her own way. So Maharaj was very influential. When I was with him towards the last days, he said, "I've done everything. I don't aspire for anything in my life. I've done everything I wanted to do except one thing. I wasn't able to get on the Oprah Winfrey TV program." Oprah Winfrey, I don't know if you know her. She is a very influential black person who preaches, has a very big TV show in America. But in the very end, just before he left, he recorded something and sent it to them, and he did a recording on their show. So he said, I've done everything. I'm ready to leave. I'm ready to leave. I've done everything I can do." And he was, he gave everything at every time. And he inspired the devotees in so many ways. He did something for ISKCON society that we'll always remember him for many things. And one thing that he did, he created a new dance step. Perhaps you've seen it. And maybe took part of it. When I was in India, when I was in Chaupati Temple, the Brahmacharis, they were doing the dance step. I was shocked to see it. They were enthusiastic dance. It's like you go side to side with the double clap, and you just, And it was so wonderful. So when I was in Detroit, and it was July 24th this year, it was the Rath Yatra ceremony. And devotees in Detroit, Maharaj was also the GBC for Detroit. So some of his disciples were there, and we were beginning the Ratha Yatra ceremony. Right at the beginning of the Ratha Yatra, a torrential rainstorm. Practically all the guests left, and only the devotees were left. None of the devotees left. We danced and chanted in the rain. It was pouring rain. And at one time during that ceremony, one of Maharaj's disciples started to lead the kirtan. And he sang the way Maharaj sang. And he sang Maharaj's favorite tune. I think it's his favorite tune. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. 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 Hare. Hare. Hare Rama, Rama, Hare Rama, 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 Hare, Hare. And when he started chanting like that, something happened to me. I don't know what it was. And I just started to dance, you know, enthusiastically. And while I was dancing, the most amazing thing happened to me. I felt Maharaj dancing next to me. It was like he came back to join the kirtan. It was so strong. It was so powerful. So Maharaj is still with us. Although he's gone physically, it says that great souls never leave. They just disappear and go on to different realms. But they're still present in their teachings, in their writings, and in the memories that we have of them especially. That's where they're really strong. So, I mean, there's so many more stories I can say. You see some of the pictures in the book there. There's one picture where I'll tell you one other story. This is a good one. This one will... I sent this story also to Satyaraj. Gita Nagari, this was in the year 2000, I think, or 2001. Every year Maharaj would have a festival in May, and it would be a 3-day festival. So this was the third day. Now when I came, Maharaj told me, he said, we have a problem. Gita Nagari owes $30,000. For a balloon payment on the property, and it's due in less than a week, about 5 days. And if we don't pay that $30,000 balloon payment, we're going to lose a significant portion of the land. So he was really worried, and he just didn't have the money. So he was thinking, they had one offer that people who cut down trees, they wanted to rent our land, cut down trees, and take the logs from the land for lumber. Maharaj says, I can't do that. I can get enough money to pay the balloon payment, but I just can't do that to the land. So he was really worried, and it was a few days left. So the last night of the festival, he was doing the puja for the arti. Maharaj would always like to do arti, and I'd be saying he would do Mangal arti. He was doing the arti, and he told me, he said, this is an interesting story, he said, I was praying to Radha Damodar while I was doing the arti, please send us the money, help us, we want to save the land, we want to save the community. And while he was doing the arti, he said, I heard a voice, and the voice said, Henry. And then it came again, Henry. And then Maharaj said, no, I can't ask Henry. Everybody's asking Henry for money. Henry's a very wealthy person, friend of the devotees. He lives in Washington, D.C. Devotees stay over his house, especially, like Prabhupada disciples. And he gives money. But, rich people, when they get hit up a lot, they start losing their faith. So he was thinking, no. But then he said... Radha Damodar kept telling me, Henry, Henry. So he said, okay. So that night he got off the altar. I was there. I watched this. He said, I'm going to go over. He told me the story right after it happened. He said, I'm going to go over and ask Henry. Henry was sitting in the temple room. He was sitting in the back. So he came up to Henry, sat down, they started talking. I was watching from a distance, watching Henry's face. waiting for, you know, whatever might happen. And at one point, Henry started to smile. And he got a big smile on his face. And then they started to talk, and Henry was really jovial, and then they left, and Maharaj came. I said, what happened? He said, the most amazing thing happened. Henry just told me that someone gave him a raffle ticket, and he won a car, which was worth about $30,000. Just the other day, someone gave him a raffle ticket, and he won a car worth $30,000. So, yes, he'll give the money, no problem. Krishna's arrangement. Eh? He got the money, paid the $30,000, and saved Gita Nagari. But the most amazing part was, you know, Damodar was telling him, Henry. He said, I heard the voice. It was like the Lord was speaking to me. Henry. And I was saying, no, Lord, I can't ask Henry. And then he kept hearing the voice, Henry. So that was Maharaj. He had that connection. Yes. He said his favorite food was pizza and ice cream. One time he was in Chicago. And Maharaj was very austere. Well, this day he was out preaching the whole day in Chicago. He came to Chicago to do a book fair, to present his books to booksellers who would come and see what books they could put in their books. So he was out all day and he hadn't eaten the whole day. So that night he came back, and one Prabhupada disciple came up to him and said, Maharaj, would you like some prasadam? He said, yeah, I haven't eaten all day. So they brought him, you know, regular Krishna prasadam. He finished the whole meal, and it was late, you know. And then he was all done, and then all of a sudden someone came in and said, Maharaj, we got pizza. He said, pizza? There's always room for pizza. He loved pizza. And so he tells that, and that's a funny story. Maharaj liked pizza. There's that one picture in the album you've seen. There's six of us in the line, we're all laughing. Hey, look at that. Maharaj is saying, yes, I want to leave my body with prasadam all over me. So he was saying, like, it was so funny. Everybody just started to crack up. So what can we say about this great personality? He touched the lives, the hearts of so many people. He preached so powerfully. And his books will live on. I guess there's so many amazing things that happened in the last year before his departure that are historical, in the sense that undergoing so much physical pain, but at the same time, preaching. He wrote that one book, I don't know if you have it in Croatian language, Die Before You Die, Die Before Dying. It's a wonderful book. He takes you on a course of all the possibilities that you can experience before a person is about to leave their body. What goes through your mind? What do you encounter? Knowing that you're going to leave soon, it's inevitable. How do you face, that inevitable leaving of the body? It's a wonderful book. It should be read by the devotees, because what he wanted to do in the last months before he left is to teach us the same principle that Prabhupada was trying to teach us, that you have to get prepared to leave. And he says, when Prabhupada was in Vrindavan and he was about to leave his body, all the devotees were around him, and it was a very heavy emotional mood. Prabhupada looked at all the devotees, and in a very serious tone he said, don't think this will not happen to you. That was his message. So Maharaj, wanting to teach us that we're going to have to go through this also, Make it easy. When great souls, they go ahead of you and they make the path easier. They make the path easier by their example, by their teachings, by their realizations. They make the path, you know, back to home, back to Godhead is a difficult path. But the lives of the great souls make the path easier for us. And he was teaching that up until the very end. You know, he was preaching, giving classes, and just relating to the devotees, and chanting. But in the last, I'd say, it was in the last, month, I visited Gita Nagari four times from the end of April to the time he left. But three of the four times were in the month of May. I left there on May 31st thinking I don't know if I'll see Maharaj again. And in that last month, he went into a kind of a seclusion. Not seclusion, but he stopped his public appearances. And he started to just stay with Radhanath Maharaj. Radhanath Maharaj was the main person who stayed with him. And Radhanath Maharaj would read him Chaitanya Charitamrita every day, and they would talk about Krishna and Vrindavan. He said, I want to immerse myself in Krishna and Vrindavan, the mood of Vrindavan. His whole room, they fixed his room up and made all pictures of Vrindavan all around the room and made his room in like a little Vrindavan. And so this was his mood. Although he was preaching, you know, issues, he was always in the mood of Vrindavan. His inner mood was Vrindavan. And one thing I think I learned about his life that I'm learning now, whatever he did it as a service to Prabhupada and as a service to the devotees. He was always trying to help the devotees. I remember he would tell me, he said, you know, there's so many problems in our movement. Our devotees are suffering. There's a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress. There's sometimes it was examples of suicides. And there was so many depression. He said, I want to do whatever I can to help the devotees, you know, overcome these problems. So he fought on that level. And for many, he was very successful. Very successful. And there's so much more. I'll read. Did the devotees read the statement by the GBC? Many of you read that. You have? Should I read it again? This is what the GBC wrote as a tribute to Maharaj. Statement: the departure of His Holiness. This is dated this is dated July 28th this year, coming from the Secretary of the GBC. The departure of His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj to join Srila Prabhupada's eternal pastimes have left ISKCON devotees worldwide with deep feelings of separation. Today we reflect on His many extraordinary accomplishments in Srila Prabhupada's service and recall with deep gratitude the immeasurable ways, both great and small, that He inspired our Krishna consciousness, strengthened our communities, and touched our hearts. During His 33 years of service to the International Society of Krishna Consciousness, His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami was the founder of the Institute for Applied Spiritual Technology, which, molded by His hands, became a powerful instrument in spreading Krishna consciousness. Systematically developed bold and unconventional methods to spread Krishna consciousness throughout the world, and thus reached those unapproachable by traditional means. As a dynamic member of the original BBT Library Party, introduced Srila Prabhupada's books to universities and libraries in the United States, Europe, and behind the Iron Curtain, with deep conviction and enthusiasm, and often at great personal risk. Wrote, it says 24 books, but actually it's more than that. There's actually 17 books. There's another book still coming out. It's Sacred Teachings number 5. It's the 25 principles taught by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. That book is still in print and will come out very soon. That's number 5 in the series of Sacred Teachings. So that's the 17th book. Here it says, wrote 24 books that explore the techniques and substance of Krishna consciousness, winning the acclaim of international experts for bringing his profound spiritual perspectives into the fields of leadership and personal growth. Was a spiritual counselor to heads of state and developed the art of winning their support to facilitate the spread of Krishna consciousness. Was honored with the position of high chief of an African tribe and thus demonstrated his expertise in connecting foreign cultures to Vaishnavism and making them fertile grounds for offering Krishna consciousness. Set a profound example of being strict within himself while lenient with others. Through his unparalleled habits of personal austerity and service and compassion for others. Was chaste, yet broad-minded. Chaste to Srila Prabhupada's ISKCON while touching the hearts of those outside of ISKCON and spiritualists throughout the world. Had compassion for suffering souls and tried to help them by offering seminars to honestly confront issues that plague us in the modern world, such as domestic abuse, depression, and suicide. Provided regular guidance to hundreds of disciples in their spiritual life and was a voice of insight, consultation, inspiration for many God brothers and God sisters. It was interesting. When his last days, all the senior devotees would come to him and they would ask Maharaj questions about ISKCON, about their personal life. And Maharaj would give answers. He would tell them, this is important. This is what you need to do. This is what we should work on. And the people were taking advice from Maharaj. Was a voice for those who had no voice. And was a powerful example to all those, to all he met, that no obstacle in this world is insurmountable if we meet determination, if met with determination, enthusiasm, and full faith in the mercy of the Supreme Lord and His pure devotees. Had a powerful and positive influence on ISKCON's governing body and commission because he knew the art of dealing with understanding and reflection, affection, thus proving that loving dealings are the basis of our society. Showed by his example how to develop intimate and caring relationships amongst devotees and the importance of providing first and foremost for their necessities in devotional life. In the last stage of his life, he was absorbed in hearing Krishna Katha, and he left this world surrounded by loving devotees and the transcendental sound vibration of the holy name. We, the governing body commission of ISKCON, express our profound bereavement at his passing. We miss him deeply as we remember and glorify his exemplary life of service to Srila Prabhupada. May his presence, wisdom, and love be felt by all of us for many years to come. So that was the statement by the GBC. Beautiful. And it's just a small part of his contribution and glories in Krishna consciousness. So, as we mentioned earlier, great souls. Bhakti Vinod Thakur wrote that famous line, he reasons ill who say that Vaishnavas die, and thou art still living and sound. Vaishnavas die to live and living spread the holy name around. So, Vaishnavas, they don't die, they just go to another place and they do the same thing. He kept saying, Prabhupada's calling me, Prabhupada's calling me, Prabhupada's calling me. And I had a little experience right around that time. I was chanting my japa. This was a few days before he left. And I was thinking about him really deeply. what he was going through. Because many of us, you know, we didn't want him to leave. Although, you know, we all understood that he was going to leave. And while I was chanting my japa, not to put myself on any special platform, I looked at Prabhupada, picture of Prabhupada. And I felt deep within the heart, yes, Prabhupada said to me, yes, I'm calling him. I'm calling him. I have some service for him. And I remembered one lecture where Tamal Krishna Goswami was speaking to Prabhupada. He says, Srila Prabhupada, is there some devotees who don't go back to Godhead but stay in the material world to preach somewhere? Prabhupada said, yes. There's a class of Vaishnavas who travel throughout the universes, and they are dedicated to the service of the Lord for wherever that service is necessary. They're preachers, they're fighters. Maharaj was a spiritual warrior. He was unique. He had that fighting spirit, and he never knew defeat. He was also always joking how he never liked to lose. He said, I never lost. I always won. He said one thing, it was funny, we were at one of his, this was in America, this was a few months, about a month before he left. He said I would play volleyball, you know, there's this game of volleyball with my devotees. And in order not to lose, I would imitate the voices of my disciples. And then they would hear that, and then they would throw the ball over there, and that way I would defeat them, you know. Said I never liked to lose. And he never lost. He always won. He won everything about his life. He was successful. He was a fighter. He was a warrior. He taught us how to fight. But he said, our weapon is love. Our weapon is devotion. Our weapon is care, kindness, and Krishna consciousness. That's our weapon. We don't fight with anger. We don't fight with the way the materialists fight. This is the war of knowledge against ignorance, the war of love against hate, and the war of devotion against non-devotion, the war of, you know, of spirituality over materialism. So he was a fighter. If you read his latest book, or maybe you have, the Spiritual Warrior 6, it's a real fighting spirit he's got in that book, very strong in that particular book. So, I mean, I can speak some more about Maharaj, there's so many more things. For me, he was a personal friend. I always saw him as my older godbrother. I would come there for advice, and he would give me advice. When we were with him in some of the last days, there was five of us. There was five sannyasis sitting in his room one day. And sometimes people would take issue with him of why he, you know, if you saw his library, they're preserving his library for the archives now. He had his Krishna Conscious Library, but he had another library that was large, about books about every subject under the sun. And when we were with him in his last days, I remember Bhakti Bhai Baba Swami, myself, Radhanath Swami, Bhakti Vishwambar Madhava Maharaj, Gunagrahi Swami, we were all sitting in his room, and he was talking. In those last days, he would talk and preach endlessly. And at one point, when we were sitting in his room, he pointed to his library. He said, I had to read all those books to do the preaching I did. He pointed to it like it was an austerity. In order for me to do that type of preaching, I had to read all these books. So it was an austerity to read all the books that he had to read in order to get information to reach people in different walks of life. So what can we say about this great soul? those of you who are disciples, you are fortunate to have such a great spiritual master. We all are fortunate, because in this movement, it's not like my guru or your guru or his guru. It's like one family. Prabhupada is the father. Prabhupada is the grandfather. And he has so many sons. And our sons are like uncles and aunts. And we are all one family. It's the family of ISKCON. That's what Prabhupada wanted. So Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj is there for everyone. We're all there for each other. We have a relationship. As we have a relationship with our spiritual master, we have a relationship with all spiritual masters. As we have a relationship with Prabhupada, we have a relationship with all of Prabhupada's devotees. It's a spiritual family. Maharaj had that mood of creating that mood of spiritual family. That means a family works together for the good of the family. And he was always preaching that, how we should work together to serve Prabhupada and to push on this Krishna consciousness movement. So I'll stop there. I have some more funny stories, but I don't know if you want to hear any funny stories. some funny stories also. We have a wonderful video which we can show. This was in June of 2004, and you can see Maharaj. I don't know if it's proper if there's anyone else who would like to speak tonight, to say anything, to add their realizations, or just to say something. You're welcome to say, to speak. I remember when I was with Maharaj in 2004, last year. No, it was 2003. This is a funny story. This is a really funny story. He would have, once a year, he would do these mass marriages. Maybe some of you attended them. One day there would be mass initiations, and then another one day would be mass marriages. So this one, there was 8 couples who were getting married. Full Vedic wedding. You know, all the mantras, all the arrangements, the whole thing. You know, colorful. The women were dressed like damsels from the heavenly planet, and the men were all, looked like demigods, And this time, what they did is they invited the relatives. So, and it was a big program, and relatives of the family, the devotees, came from all over the country. And some of these were like materialists, and people in the material world had big jobs, and they came to see their daughter or their son or their nephew get married. So there was about 25 of them. They came, and we had a wonderful program, and they sat through the whole wedding, and they were like shocked to see how we get married. Wow, that is far out. And they were even taking part. They were assisting, because at certain parts, the mother and the father have to give away the children, and put different things on them. It's all real fancy. I don't know all of it, but it's really colorful. So we had this whole beautiful wedding ceremony. So, right after that, there was a drama. And guess what the drama play was? You'll never guess. You'll never guess the drama. One of Maharaj's disciples, she created this drama. It's just from the Shastras, but she decided to put it on for this occasion. Do you know the story of the yogi and the Kopins? Where the yogi, he's sitting on the banks of the river, and all he has in his possession is 2 pairs of Kopins. So he wears one and he hangs the other one up to dry after he takes bath. So a mouse comes along and starts chewing on his Kopins. And it's a problem because that's all he has. So he decides, I'll tell you this story. It's kind of it's a brahmachari story, the whole story. The story is that, you know, he doesn't know what to do. So friend tells him, well, you need to get a cat. The cat can keep away the mice, that way you can meditate. Because he wasn't being distracted from his meditation. So he gets a cat. So the cat chases the, you know, the mice away, and his Brahmins are okay. His gopins are okay. So then, but then he hears, meow, meow. Cat needs to get fed. So he's thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? I'm trying to meditate here, and I meow. So this play is going on. So a friend tells him, well, you need to get a cow. That way you can milk the cow, and then you can give the milk to the cat who'll keep away the mouse. So you can have good brown and copens. So he gets a cow. But then, you know, he has to milk the cow, and it becomes a real burden. And then he doesn't know what to do. So he has to feed the cow and milk the cow. He's thinking, I have no time to take care of my, you know, meditation. So his friend says, well, what you need is to get a wife so you can have her milk the cow and take care of the cow. She can give the milk to the cat, and the cat can, you know, take care of the mice. And that way you can meditate. So he says, yeah, that's a good idea. So he gets married. So then she's milking the cow and taking care of the cow and giving it. But then she's thinking, you know, what about me? You know, I don't have to live like this on the bank of the river just milking this cow. I want a house. You know, I'm your wife. So she's complaining to him. So she's saying, you know, you ought to get a job. So he's thinking, well, you have to get a job to support the wife so she can milk the cow, so the cow can give the milk to the cat, and the cat can keep my Brahmins, so I can meditate. But he's got no time for meditation anymore because it's so complicated. So this is going on. And this play is going on right after that marriage with all these guests who came to see their children get married. And I'm sitting there with Maharaj, and we're watching the play, and his mouth is... And I looked at him, I said, Maharaj, what happened? He says, I don't know. I said, this play is not appropriate for this occasion. It's just not appropriate. You got all these guests, you know, they're all dressed up. They see their children get married. They're all happy. They saw a Vedic wedding. And now this play is going on. So we didn't know whether to laugh or cry or do both or just get out of there as fast as we could. But somehow this play went on, and it went on for a long time. I mean, I won't mention the devotee who did the play because I don't want to get her in trouble. But she was really into the whole play. It went on for a long time. She did it with every little detail as you can possibly put into that play. And the guests, they were looking. And I think Krishna just covered them over. I don't think they could figure out what was happening. They sat through the whole play, and afterwards nobody said anything. And the program went on. We went outside and had a big dinner, beautiful, you know, we had first class prasadam and nice tables, tablecloth with, you know, flowers and so many nice decorations. And the whole program was successful. But that play, it was like most funniest thing. And I was so shocked that I was afraid to come up to the devotee and ask her why she did that play. I didn't say anything. I just kept quiet. But I said, Mara, just you know, we were just laughing and at the same time crying, hoping that the guests were okay after the play. So we had many wonderful times together. This is just one of the times we shared together. And of course, I know all of you have your wonderful memories. So in those last days that when Maharaj, before leaving, he preached the glories of Krishna consciousness, and he set the example of the perfect spiritual master, taking care of his devotees to the very end and teaching them the importance of, you know, remaining fixed in Krishna consciousness. So we can still associate with Maharaj. One devotee said to me, he's not gone, he just went on a trip. And someday he'll come back and we'll see him again. He's just traveling somewhere. So that's the fact. And we can also join him on his trip personally, and we can also join him in spirit as we, you know, imbibe those teachings that he taught, which were the basis of the teachings that Prabhupada taught. If you say the word sun in any language, it's still the same sun. So taking, say, Prabhupada's teachings and speaking a certain language that made it understandable, as it says here, by people who couldn't or was having a difficult time approaching spiritual life in the traditional way, he spoke their language. So, if anyone would like to add anything, feel free to do so. You don't feel like you have to, because I wanted to bring this little program today as a memory to Maharaj. Because as we remember great souls, then we also glorify the Lord. Because the devotees who live for the Lord and the Lord Himself is non-different. So glorifying the great souls is actually more pleasing to the Lord than glorifying the Lord. When we glorify the Lord, it's nice, and we're supposed to do that, and that is Krishna consciousness. But when we glorify those persons who dedicate their lives to glorifying and serving the Lord and His devotees, the Lord becomes more pleased. The Lord is more happy. So we take this occasion to give great pleasure to the Lord and His devotees by remembering Bhakti Tirtha Swami for everything he did. His life was exemplary, and there'll be much more. He said, "My books will live on, and they will have a great effect in the world." And they're already doing that now. They're reaching the hearts of many. One godbrother of mine, he was telling a story. We were having a program glorifying Maharaj. He told one story. He said his friend came to meet him one day, and they were talking, and his friend said, "You know, I know I also have some connection with spiritual teachings. In fact, I got this one book by this one devotee, by this one spiritualist. It's a great book. You should read it. It's really nice. I've never read a book like this. I've read so many books on spiritual life, but this is the best." The devotee was thinking, "Oh yeah, he's just speaking about some Mayavadi or some impersonalist." He said, "I have it in my briefcase. I can't remember the name of the book or the author, but I'll show it to you." He said, "Well, you can show it to me later." He says, "No, I want to show it to you. This person is really right on." takes it out, and it was one of the books in the Spiritual Warriors series. He said, "Oh, that's my godbrother, Bhakti Tirtha Swami." He said, "Oh, really?" So, you know, he really knows how to speak. So, you know, it's like that. He reaches people who don't know much connection with our movement. Okay. So if we like, we can go on to the next stage, and that is there's a wonderful video of Maharaj leading kirtan. It's 50 minutes of kirtan. If you like, you can watch. And you can see how he's inspiring devotees to dance and chant. So, without any further ado, maybe we can begin the video. So, get yourself a comfortable seat, or you can sit